And we're wearing the green today. I wonder why.
Peter B. Collins!
Let's see if we can get some Irish music fired up here. Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, March 17th, 2017. It is St. Paddy's Day, and I want to dedicate this podcast to the memory of my dear old Irish dad, who would have been 94 tomorrow. And we've been experimenting for a couple of months now with the Facebook Live video feed here on Fridays. I'm glad that you have clicked in. I see a handful of people are watching already. If you're watching, can I ask you to share it and invite other people to join this live video feed of my daily news and comment podcast? And if you're not familiar with this guy, Peter B. Collins, I'm a longtime radio host. I'm an uncompromising leftist. I'm a strict constitutionalist, and I call him as I see him. And I appreciate the people who support my work with your subscriptions. We'll talk to about some of those people midway through the podcast. And at the end of the half hour here, at the bottom of the hour, I'm going to open up the phone lines and see who wants to talk, see who has a comment on some of the news and comment that I have offered here in the this next half hour. So the controversies continue, and we have a fact-free free-for-all when it comes to the counter-allegations and cross-allegations that Trump Tower was somehow tapped or surveilled upon by the Obama administration. And we have these carefully crafted denials that are remarkably coming from Republicans who had been supportive of many of President Trump's most ridiculous comments. Now, as you're about to see, I don't have a firm view of whether Trump is right or not, but I find it interesting that the corporate media and elected leaders are basically encircling him and saying bullshit. Here is Richard Burr. He is the committee chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and he went bipartisan. He got his ranking Democrat, Mark Warner, the senator from Virginia, to join in this statement. And listen to the carefully crafted statement. Based on the information available to us, which that is a caveat you can drive a Mack truck through, we see no indications that Trump Tower was the subject of surveillance by any element of the United States government either before or after Election Day 2016. All right? So the denial is that there was no surveillance of Trump Tower. But we know that Mike Flynn got caught talking to the Russians. He was fired for it. His call was intercepted, and we don't know how. We don't know who did it. We don't know who supplied the transcripts to the New York Times and the Washington Post. Then we have Devin Nunes, the California Republican who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, and he has pissed all over himself recently by first trying to support Trump, and now he has been backed into a corner. He said, I don't think there was an actual tap of Trump Tower. Now, you can't tap a tower, right? Towers don't make phone calls. They don't send emails. So Nunes went on to say, and by the way, he doesn't use the Enya. As a Republican, he pronounces his name Nunes, not Nunez, as most California Latinos might. Anyway, he went on to say that if you're taking Trump's tweets literally, which he advised people not to do, then, quote, clearly, the president was wrong. So that's what official Washington is saying to Trump. Then you have the corporate media, led by the New York Times, headline in the Friday paper. Trump clings to accusations widely rejected. Now, one of the theories that I have discussed most recently with Yasha Levine in an in-depth interview we released a couple of days ago is that it's possible for the Obama administration and the entire intelligence community to say, we didn't tap Trump, or even more narrowly, we didn't tap Trump Tower. But it's possible that they got the information from other means. We know the NSA routinely wiretaps international phone calls and surveils people from other countries. That's their job, and we claim that that's okay. And we don't know where the transcript cited by the New York Times came from. But if there are transcripts, and again, this is a fact-free exercise, then who made those transcripts and who recorded the conversation for the transcripts to be generated from? And so when you look at this in the circle that's been created, the president is the one who can lift the veils of secrecy and declassify any information that he sees fit to do so. And he could end this circle of speculation just like that. But he seems to revel in this. And the interesting thing for me is that we are seeing an education of the American people about the depth of electronic and other surveillance that is underway in this country on a daily basis, and that drags in that draws into its dragnet millions of innocent people. And in a moment, we'll get to Senator Ron Wyden's efforts to define the number of exactly how many millions of Americans are illegally and unconstitutionally surveilled on a daily basis. Now, yesterday, I don't know if you've seen this clip, but Sean Spicer went postal. He was asked by a reporter about the claims of President Trump that he or Trump Tower was wiretapped. And he went into a 10-minute tirade that was scripted. He had all these notes of articles that he was citing. And toward the end, one of the articles that he referred to, or a document, was a quote from Andrew Napolitano, the former judge and Fox News far-right-wing commentator. And he said that based on three sources of his, that he is alleging that it was the British equivalent of the NSA, called GCHQ, that actually conducted whatever surveillance or wiretapping of the Trump campaign may or may not have taken place. Now, it's fair to note that that Fox News itself says they can't confirm what their host, Andrew Napolitano, reported on their network. And this shows you the idiocy of the secrecy that we live with every day, layers and layers of secrecy. And I've talked to NSA whistleblowers who frankly tell you that the so-called Five Eyes, the United States, Canada, Britain, New Zealand, Australia, they conspire and collude on a daily basis so that when the Aussies need a wiretap that's illegal in their country, they just call up Canada or the United States or Britain and say, hey, guys, can you handle this one for us? We'll pay you back. And so it's entirely possible that what Sean Spicer blurted out based on Andrew Napolitano's on-air comments may be true. But in official Washington, where we don't acknowledge the information that is labeled secret, but that we know about, we have to play the secrets game. And so we have these denials. Oh, no, it couldn't have been the British, and the British are outraged that this has even been suggested. They have won some commitment from the Trump White House that these allegations will not be repeated. But again, all of this bullshit could end in a moment if the guy who's called president would exercise the authority to expose these issues. And Trump even tried to make a joke about it. Just before I sat down here, I got word of a news conference that he held with German Chancellor Angela Merkel visiting the White House today. And after a German reporter asked Trump about the unproven allegations that Barack Obama wiretapped his phones in Trump Tower, he said, well, as far as the wiretapping by this past administration, at least we have something in common, perhaps. So he's referring to Merkel, whose phone was tapped in 2010 on orders from, we're told, President Obama. So Trump is claiming that there's more information, that we should keep our minds open, and that he may even talk about this next week. But it is a bizarre cycle that began with his Saturday morning tweets, where he blamed Obama. And because this whole exercise You know, going back to last summer and the pile of unproven allegations of Russian involvement, Russian hacking, Russian manipulation, Russia got Trump elected. We have a nation that is in chaos, and we don't have a rational and factual basis to try to return to ground and say, okay, let's all agree on a few facts here. It's unlikely we're going to find that ground anytime soon. This is the Peter B. Collins Podcast. We're live on Facebook today, and I'm glad you're watching and joining us. Coming up on the half hour, I'll be opening up the phone lines and looking for your comments. You can talk about this or any other issue that's in the news. My phone number is 415-455-0102. Call whenever you like. I'll start taking calls on the half hour, 415-455-0102. I mentioned Ron Wyden. He is the senator from Oregon, a Democrat, and he's the one who caught James Clapper, the previous director of national intelligence, in an act of perjury. Under oath, in congressional testimony, Clapper was asked how many millions of Americans are surveilled on a daily basis, and Clapper said, none that I can recall or I can think of. And he later said he gave the least dishonest answer that he could muster under pressure. Well, Wyden is continuing to chase for an answer to that question, and he's chasing Clapper's successor, the former Indiana Senator Dan Coats, who was confirmed this week as the new director of national intelligence. That's one of the agencies that the Trump team has threatened to eliminate. At any rate, Wyden kept peppering questions to Dan Coats, both in public testimony and by a follow-up letter. And Coats was confirmed without answering the question. Wyden says, I and other members of Congress have been seeking an answer since 2011. We posed the question again in the context of reauthorization of Section 702. That's a part of the FISA reform law of 2008. The one that candidate Obama said he would vote against, and after he got the nomination, he voted for it. And he used the authorities under Section 702 quite liberally. And this is where we believe the metadata collection of all our phone records is allegedly authorized. So Ron Wyden disappoints me at times because he seems to be more interested in process than in totally protecting our Fourth Amendment rights. But he's the only one who really pursues these issues, and I'm glad he does. Meanwhile, the FBI has won a victory as a federal judge has denied a request under the Freedom of Information Act to reveal the agency's rules about using national security letters. These are warrants that don't require a court order. They're essentially executed by an FBI agent, sometimes with the approval of his or her boss. And they've been widely abused. And that has been reported by the inspectors general of the Justice Department itself. So, in federal court, District Judge Haywood Gilliam refused to order the release of the FBI's rules about using national security letters on journalists. Now, this is an issue of serious public importance. The First Amendment, as far as I currently know, is still in effect. And yet, the FBI is able to maintain secrecy. And the judge said, well, they described with particularity that the withheld documents all contain non-public information about the FBI's investigative techniques and procedures. These pages not only identified NSLs as an investigative technique, but also described information like the circumstances under which the techniques should be used. Well, duh. That's what we deserve to know. These are levels of secrecy that are un-American, unconstitutional. And I hope within my lifetime, we will look back on these days and say, wow, we really went off the rails, didn't we? I hope, you can tell, I hope that we see that happen someday. Spencer Ackerman is a great reporter who works for The Guardian. He was previously at Wired magazine, and he reports at The Guardian today something that we have suspected. During the final years of the Obama administration, they developed what was called the Countering Violent Extremism Initiative, CVE. And we were told that this was a nice touchy-feely effort to try to identify Americans before they became fully radicalized and got an FBI informant who led them to try to commit a crime. That last part is my editorial, as you can tell. Anyway, Ackerman is reporting that new documents reveal that the effort to counter violent extremism was really just another surveillance program aimed at the American Muslim community. The Obama administration portrayed CVE as a community-led approach to addressing terrorism and strenuously denied that it was a surveillance program. But law enforcement agencies charged with investigating and prosecuting terrorism sit at the center of these programs and see them as a way to collect information about Muslims who are not suspected of any crime. That's a quote from Faiza Patel, who I've spoken with before. She's the lead author of this study from the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. And this is part of the overall degradation of our constitutional rights and the expansion of police state activities here in the United States. Today, I'm releasing an in-depth interview to my subscribers at peterbcollins.com, at TuneIn, Stitcher, Spreaker, also at iTunes, wherever you find my podcast. And I want to recommend this new film. I spoke with the filmmakers, and the movie is called For Here or To Go. Now, you probably think, oh, is this a fast food setting? No. This is about people who come from other countries who are highly skilled, highly educated individuals, often working in Silicon Valley, but not exclusively, and they are here on what are called H-1B visas. It's a special category of visa. There are a couple of 100,000 of them that are in circulation, and the people who come here on an H-1B have sharp restrictions on their ability to jump from the employer who sponsored them to a competitor who might pay them more or give them a better gig. And so the film centers on a software engineer named Vivek Pandit. And it's not a documentary, and as I told the filmmakers, they could have made a documentary, and I'm glad they didn't. But it's a feature film that gives you the point of view of an individual who is here on an H-1B visa. And Vivek is scrambling because he got a better offer, but they can't get him out of his old H-1B contract with his current employer, who he hates. And then time is running out on his H-1B. And it's a fascinating look at real life of non-citizens in Silicon Valley. So I interviewed the filmmakers yesterday in San Francisco, Rucha Humnabadkar and Rishi Bilawadkar. And I apologize if I have mangled their names. But they're fascinating people. And in this excerpt from my in-depth interview, oh, I have to turn off the Irish music here, sorry, I got them to comment on the new royal decree from Donald Trump banning travel to the United States from six predominantly Muslim countries. First up, the writer-producer Rishi, followed by the director Rucha.
I think we are seeing the public reaction to this. It is very harmful to the perception of America. It adds a lot of trouble to, you know, people who are already here. Already the lives are uncertain, as you're seeing in the film. This adds a whole new twist of uncertainty. You really don't know where you're going to be next day, next week, next month. It's very difficult to live under that cloud of uncertainty as it is. So I think it's a very difficult time for being an outsider. It always is difficult being an outsider and getting accepted, but now more and more the perception is that, it is becoming much more unwelcoming and hateful. Especially there have been violent crimes. I'm sure you're aware there were shootings in Kansas. An Indian engineer was fatally shot. And it's just very scary.
Right. Well, and that incident really is an example of the deep ignorance, because he thought the person he shot was Iranian. And we see that quite a bit, where Sikhs are, who have no stake in any Muslim-Christian struggle, are misidentified and attacked by ugly Americans. Mm-hmm. Rucha?
Yes, it's really unfortunate the time we live in right now. I recently became a U.S. citizen, and, everything that I believe America stands for, the values that we uphold that make this country great, the reason why I think I came here, or everybody comes here, seems to be hanging in the balance with the way things are right now. And I think it's our responsibility as citizens to stand up to that. And I really feel this film is going to help people understand, raise awareness, educate, and kind of even become empathetic to what the situation is.
That's Rucha, the filmmaker, and I do recommend this film. Check around and see if it's going to be showing. It opens here in the San Francisco Bay Area at the end of March. And again, the film is called For Here or to Go, and you can find more information on their website, foreheorortogomovie.com. And as I mentioned, the in-depth interview is being released to my subscribers today. And the way it works, my in-depth interviews are exclusive to subscribers for the first 2 weeks after I release them. And I value the subscribers who support my work. And I went to my secret P.O. box recently, and Linda Lewis, who is a regular subscriber, took out a new annual subscription and also just kicked in an extra $10. Linda, thank you very much. Also, I want to thank Alex Marin, who followed through on her threat to send a couple of $100 to me from Surprise, Arizona. A nice surprise from her. And also I want to thank longtime listener and supporter Keita Tom in Corvallis, Oregon. If you'd like to become a subscriber, just wander over to peterbcollins.com. There's a menu button no matter what device you use. Click on that, pull it down, go to Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page. And I dangle bonus books on the sign-up page for people who take out a new annual subscription. Check it all out at peterbcollins.com. So there's a lot of hand-wringing going on, and I do understand the budget blueprint that was released perhaps as a diversion from the healthcare debate by the Trump White House yesterday is draconian. There's no doubt about it. The first thing I would say is that these budget proposals from the White House rarely are embraced by the Congress in the same form that they are produced by the White House. So this will all shift going down the road. But what the Trump budget blueprint does is it is an index of cruelty and greed. It reflects the interests of the 1% and simply bulldozes any issue that was raised by Occupy and the obvious disparities that were a centerpiece of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign last year. We don't matter. It's only the wealthy, and we're supposed to stoke it all in their direction so it will trickle down to us eventually. I guess that's the faith that we're supposed to embrace. But this is a license for the GOP extremists in Congress, because when Trump says, let's cut the NEA, let's eliminate it, the National Endowment for the Arts, well, there are a lot of members of Congress who are eager to do that. They think it'll, you know, crush public radio and public television, and it will hurt both of those entities if this goes forward. But I think usually we see that the extremes are not what ends up in the final budget. But also, it's a scary proposal built on Ronald Reagan's attack on the air traffic controller union. Trump wants to privatize the entire air traffic control system. Do you want your safety on an airliner to depend on some guy who works for a cheapo corporation that just made him work 12 hours with no overtime? I'm obviously hypothetically describing this, but that's the kind of extreme you'll see. So the Trump budget, 10% increase for defense, 7% for homeland security, 6% for veterans, and everything else gets cut. Deepest cuts for the EPA, the State Department, and the Department of Agriculture. Oh, and labor takes a 21% hit, too. So that's the idea that they are pushing. And let's just take one sector of this. Obviously, the budget is too big for me to comment on in every respect. But the National Coordinating Agency for Homelessness is called the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. And they want to completely eliminate that office. And it does a lot of good work coordinating efforts to help the homeless and to find funding for local efforts. Also, the plan to deep cuts in the Housing and Urban Development Department, where they've dispatched the pediatric brain surgeon Ben Carson to surgically cut housing? Well, there's an estimation that over 200,000 people may lose their housing because of the cutbacks at HUD. And they'll become homeless and add to the problems we already face in this country. It's unconscionable. And to increase the military budget at the expense of very human needs, they're talking about cutting Meals on Wheels and after-school snack programs because Mitch Mulvaney doesn't think that they do much. Well, to see this kind of cruelty displayed in public and people proudly embracing it is just disgustingly un-American. My lines are open if you'd like to join me for live call-ins in just a few minutes. 415-455-0102. Why don't you be brave and be the first caller? Get on the line right now, 415-455-0102. Well, there's a mystery helicopter that mowed down 40 Somali refugees who were on a boat off the coast of Yemen in the middle of the night. And we have to suspect that it was a Saudi helicopter, an American-made, an Apache attack helicopter. And the Saudis say, oh, no, we didn't do it. We didn't have any operations in the area. The U.S. says, oh, no, we didn't do it. But it's one of the two. And it's really sad that these innocent people who were fleeing starvation got caught up in the crossfire of another American-influenced hot war in the Middle East. And just up the road in Syria, 6 years on of the conflict in that country, the U.S. unleashed some drone strikes that the Pentagon claims killed dozens of members of al-Qaeda. But in fact, it mowed down 46 or more civilians who were attending services at a mosque. And many of them are people who recently survived the brutal assault on Aleppo. And they also used what is called a double tap. That means they launch Hellfire missiles, kill a bunch of people, and then they wait a few minutes, and as first responders show up, they hit them again. Over at the United Nations, there is an agency that has blurted out the truth, and it's causing a lot of pushback. A commission said in a report on Wednesday that Israel practices apartheid against the Palestinians. I think that's flatly true. But, of course, Israel has its own set of facts and reality, and they say, oh, we're the only functioning democracy in the Middle East, as if a democracy can't practice apartheid. So this is, I think, building up. The Israelis are really pushing back hard against people like me who support boycott, divestment, and sanctions until the apartheid policies are dismantled. And instead of responding to the focal point of the movement of BDS and responding to the legitimate issues raised on behalf of the Palestinians, the Israelis just continue to deny this and to demonize people, including former President Jimmy Carter, who used the term apartheid to describe Israel several years ago in the subtitle of one of his books. And, of course, the United States comes to the defense of Israel and doesn't, again, try to parse these claims and say, well, you know, is this apartheid and can we do anything to fix it? Meanwhile, oil man turned diplomat Rex Tillerson, I call him Rexon Tillerson. He was the CEO of ExxonMobil up until 6 weeks ago. He went on a foreign junket, left the American reporters behind, and then held a news conference in Asia, where he applied what I call whiplash diplomacy. Speaking of North Korea, Rexon Tillerson first told them, North Korea and its people need not fear the United States or their neighbors in the region who seek only to live in peace with North Korea. With this in mind, the United States calls on North Korea to abandon its nuclear and ballistic missile program and refrain from any further provocations. Now that's soothing, isn't it? But this white man speak with forked tongue. Because not too much later. Rexon Tillerson said a preemptive U.S. military strike against North Korea may be necessary if the threat posed by its nuclear weapons program reaches a level that requires action. And he said that the era of patience, strategic patience toward North Korea, is over. Not sure what to make of that, but it's hard to see that as diplomacy. So as I mentioned earlier, Angela Merkel came to the White House today, and it's a very tense series of photo ops. Nobody could summon a smile. And Trump fumbled the issues related to the costs of NATO and his claim that the U.S. pays a disproportionate share. And Merkel, I think, was being as diplomatic as she could, and she attempted to just, you know, let that roll off her shoulder. So the one quote I have from Merkel is, "It's always better to talk to one another than about one another." But it was clearly a frosty meeting between the two leaders. I want to commend the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. Her name is Tani Cantil Sakau. And yesterday she issued a statement asking federal immigration agents, the guys from ICE, to stop stalking California courthouses. She said courthouses should not be used as bait in the necessary enforcement of our country's immigration laws. Enforcement policies that include stalking courthouses and arresting undocumented immigrants, the vast majority of whom pose no risk to public safety, are neither safe nor fair. They not only compromise our core values of fairness, but they undermine the judiciary's ability to provide equal access to justice. And imagine an undocumented woman who goes to a courthouse to seek a restraining order from a domestic violence case. And as she leaves the courthouse, she gets picked up by ICE. That has happened more than once in recent weeks. I also want to commend a woman who is the chief prosecutor, the new one, in Orlando, Florida, Aramis D. Ayala, A-Y-A-L-A, because she announced this week that she will no longer seek the death penalty in cases brought by her office. And she mustered the typical arguments: the death penalty has failed as a deterrent, it does nothing to protect law enforcement officers. She also cited the length of time between sentencing and execution, which often exceeds 10 years, and the costs of capital cases. But, of course, knee-jerk reaction and pandering to advocates for the death penalty was almost instant, because within hours, Governor Rick Scott, the Republican, issued an executive order removing Ayala from a case involving the death of an Orlando police officer. My lines are open to talk to you this afternoon, and if you'd like to join me, you got to do it now. Get on the line immediately at 415-455-0102. You're welcome to discuss any issue that I've brought up or anything else that is noteworthy to our general audience. Don't complain about the mileage on your car or your grocery bills. But if you have a comment of public value, please call now at 415-455-0102. We had a couple of stories this week that were overhyped in the corporate media, and many of my listeners and viewers, I'm sure, saw Rachel Maddow's dramatic performance on Tuesday night. It was teased by MSDNC that she had Donald Trump's tax returns. Well, it turned out she had the summary pages from 1 year, and it wasn't that big of a story. But it generated the largest audience in the history of the Rachel Maddow Show, more than 4 million viewers. It is the second highest rated hour in the history of MSNBC. The record is still held by Keith Olbermann back in October of 2008. But at what price to the credibility of Rachel Maddow? Because she's drawn strong criticism from me and many others for using the tax returns for a recap of her largely evidence-free claims of the Russian conspiracy, the spy novel that she updates in installments every night. And she very cleverly, but without any real evidence, tried to link Trump's tax returns to the idea that they might support her speculation about some of his deals with Russia or with Russian oligarchs. And those are worthy of investigation, make no mistake about it. But his tax returns and the summary pages didn't shed any light on that. And so I think the criticism has been fair. And while it's always nice to get good ratings, and I used to work in the commercial media, and ratings are important, blah, 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 credibility is even more important. And David K. Johnston, who supplied the documents, he doesn't know where they came from and freely speculates that Trump or someone close to him may have leaked those documents. Well, that is worth pursuing. We may never find out, but I do believe that Rachel overplayed her hand, and I'd like to hear her acknowledge that. Here's another item that was overhyped by the media, including Rachel Maddow this week, and that was the election in the Netherlands, where Geert Wilders, or Wilders, is was described as the Dutch Donald Trump. And they really overplayed and overhyped the possibility that he could win a majority and form a government. Well, he didn't even come close. He got about 13% overall. And the real winner, and I didn't hear this in any corporate media reports, including Rachel Maddow, she hammered home that Geert Wilders was not victorious. But the real winner in the elections in Holland, please hold on, I'll be with you in a moment. Let's see if this will work here. Just stand by, I'll take your call here in a moment, all right? Let me push this button and hold on, I'll be with you in a moment. Anyway, related to the Dutch election, the claim that Trump and Brexit were leading indicators that this right-wing Muslim hater was going to be victorious in Holland was just really unsubstantiated. And certainly I understand how trends develop and the media loves trends, and they saw Brexit and Trump and they just said, wow, Holland will be next. Well, the real victor in Holland is the Green Party, led by a 30-year-old guy named Jesse Klaver, and they scored the biggest parliamentary gains on the left. They went from 4 to 14 seats in the parliament, where the total combined conservative parties increased their number of seats to 57% in the parliament. So it did produce a rightward tilt, but it also produced big gains for the Green Party in Holland. And that has not been, I think, appropriately emphasized in the coverage that I have seen over the last couple of days. So I got a couple more items that I'll get to here shortly, but I want to take your phone calls, and I have lines open for you at 415-455-0102. And if it starts ringing, just stay on the line, and I'll get to you as fast as I can. There's no voicemail that'll pick up, so just let it ring, and we'll take your call. And who is this on line one, please?
Hi, Peter. Is it me?
Hi, it's you. You're on the air. Who's me?
This is Susan.
Susan in Monterey, Aptos, somewhere. Somewhere down there.
Somewhere down there, yes.
Yeah, it's great to hear your voice, Susan. How are you doing?
I'm doing well as I can. You sound great. I'm one of these people who's like dependent on Medicare and all of that stuff, so I don't know what's going to be happening. But this is what I was wondering. I didn't catch the beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you dealt with that bombing that happened in Syria, where supposedly we attacked an Al-Qaeda place, but we actually attacked this mosque.
Yes, yes, I did cover it. It was about 12 minutes into the podcast. We have a situation there where, once again, the Pentagon is claiming that we just vanquished a bunch of evil militants, and the reports on the ground clearly indicate that we killed non-militant civilians in a mosque, and that some of these people had just survived the brutal assault on Aleppo.
I don't know why I'm not seeing anything about it in place. Now, I don't have regular TV anymore, so I get everything on my computer, and I can't afford to subscribe to everything either, so I only get a few things.
Well, let me give you a couple of tips, okay, for free online outlets. For the Middle East, Mondo Weiss is a great website that does critical reporting of Israel.
And Mondo Weiss,
I think it's mondoweiss.net.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Consortiumnews.com, that's Robert Perry's site, has been providing some of the best critical and skeptical coverage of the whole Russia, you know, the arc of stories about Russia. Counterpunch is a great website. I use The Guardian and The Independent with from Britain, but I'm careful because they do have some biases that show up in different places. And so, you know, those are some just off the top of my bald head.
Also been watching, because they have a little humor, and that helps. I've been watching Sam Cedar and Michael Brook, and what I like about their show is that they have some really great interviews. I don't know if you pay any attention to them, but it's quite amazing.
I haven't checked in on them lately. Another outlet that I really respect is the Young Turks.
Well, they get a little... I don't know what there is about the Young Turks. I love them, and they bother me. And I think maybe it's kind of unbridled youth. I'm not super old yet, and I still have a lot of energy. But I would prefer a little bit of tempering of what they're doing. Actually, you're dealing with
well,
news.
but Susan, this is where you have I think the duty as a consumer of news to and I urge you to apply it to me just like anybody else. All right, identify the biases of the source that you are accessing. And then apply your own knowledge and objective and rational reasoning to the news that you have just absorbed. And you remember the slogan we used to use at KRXA?
Which one?
Think for yourself.
I think for yourself, right. that's what I've always done. And, you know, I owe that to my dad. When I was very little, he taught me to read between the lines, not believe what I heard, but to really look further. And I was pretty young. And he was a Greek immigrant person who never really even finished school, but he was so educated. And he taught me a lot. And I'm so grateful for that.
All right. Well, Susan, I'm grateful for your call. I'm glad to hear from you. And we used to talk
on a... I'm glad you're there.
Well, I'm going to keep being here, so check in. And like I say... Don't believe everything anybody says, including Peter B. Collins, okay?
Yourself. All right. Love you,
Peter. All right. Bye, Susan. That's Susan over in the Monterey area. And I've got lines open and some time here if you'd like to call in and comment. We're still just in the early stages of this Facebook Live feed. A lot of people are figuring it out. Many of you are at work. You can't pick up the phone because you're sneaking a peek at the screen right now. I understand that, okay. But if you're free to call, give me a buzz right now, 415-455-0102. Now, last week at this time, I got a call from Ray Lutz in San Diego. Ray's a guy I really respect. He is an activist on election integrity and also on nuclear power plants. And he has been one of the citizen activists at the table negotiating with Southern California Edison to try to reduce the impact of the shutdown of the San Onofre nuclear units on the ratepayers, because the Edison company is trying to jam ratepayers with $3.3 billion in shutdown costs for San Onofre. And there was a recent settlement with the Mitsubishi Heavy Equipment Company. It was their defective equipment that led to the shutdown of San Onofre. But here's an unexpected consequence, at least from my point of view. I was not aware of this, because they are building a major nuclear waste storage site right there at San Onofre. And they're building it within 100 feet of the Pacific Ocean. There's a new Google Earth satellite image that shows that the construction is underway to put the spent fuel, estimated at 3 million pounds, into storage units right there at the San Onofre complex. Now, haven't we learned a goddamn thing from Fukushima? You know the answer to that question. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show. Who's this?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. Who's this?
Okay, this is Ray Lutz.
Ray's back. All right, Ray. Well, go ahead and add to this because
So here's the thing. There's 3.6 million pounds of high-level nuclear waste that was generated by the San Onofre plant.
Mm-hmm.
And there really isn't any good place for it. You can't just disappear it. It looks the same as it did when it went in. It's just that it's actually more dangerous than it was when it went in, but also it is not useful for running a plant. But there's no good place for it. This spot on the edge of the water, within 100 feet of the ocean, as people can see in the Google image,
mm-hmm.
and on the Ring of Fire, where 90% of the earthquakes on Earth happen. Next to a major freeway, next to a railroad line, within bounds of 8.4 million people in a tsunami area, has to be one of the worst places to ever think of putting this nuclear waste.
Yeah.
Yet, when you combine profiteering with the regulatory agencies, this is what they come up with, and it's I think likely to be there pretty much forever because. Once they put it in the ground, it's going to be really, really hard to get it out. They'll say, well, it's fine where it is. It's going to be too risky to take it out. And what I fear is that there'll be some the salt air will corrode these things. They'll become breached. We'll have some sort of a small nuclear accident there. And then we're going to have to cover it over with concrete. And forever, this is going to be a nuclear site. So what we've done is we've filed a lawsuit against the Coastal Commission, and the hearing on this is on March 30th. This mm-hmm. is in San Diego, and we're asking for anybody in the area who wants to help us. We're going to be having some events, press releases and stuff on that Monday, and then if people would like to come to the hearing, of course, we'd like to have people just overflowing, because as you look at this, I don't know of anyone who says, that looks like a good place for nuclear waste. I mean, it is just absurd.
Yeah.
It's difficult. What we want them to do is at least review other options, and they really didn't do this. They said it's just going to be just no other options are available because we'd have to go through licensing and so forth. But I think it'd be better to just leave it in the fuel pools for now, at least for the next couple of few years. It was supposed to be there for 40 years, so it's not like we're really changing things. And then see if there's some other options available that are not right on the ocean, not in the earthquake zone. And you know, they just had a new study that was just done. The utilities had to pay for it, which looked at the seismic risk right along the coast. And this Newport Englewood Rose Canyon fault line, they decided, is one continuous fault line that has the capability of a 7.4 earthquake. And that's just within a few kilometers of where they're putting this.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't know how big the earthquakes can be. I mean, we've really only had earthquake science for really only 50 years or so. And now they're betting that this is going to be a good place for up to a million years. I mean, this stuff is deadly. Deadly for million up to at least 250,000 years, 2,500 centuries.
And Ray, you know, this is the most fundamental problem with nuclear power, that we have never dealt with the waste. And of course, we have significant waste from nuclear weapons and other non-weapon uses of isotopes. But, you know, it's just scientifically unconscionable that we went forward with the construction of a fleet of more than 100 nuclear power generating units without knowing how to deal with the waste produced. And I know the issues about Yucca Mountain. It's not a perfect repository for nuclear waste. But we need to come up with some solution for dealing with this problem, because it's not going to get any easier. And we have been, I believe, so reckless and careless with the nuclear waste issue that, I wish we could do something dramatic like they did in Japan after Fukushima and shut them all down. That still will not deal with the disposal and storage issue. And I think that we need some sort of a Manhattan Project, if you will, aimed at dealing exclusively with the nuclear waste issue.
Well, here's a double-edged sword to that. If you solve the nuclear waste issue, then there'll be proponents of nuclear energy that say, oh, okay, well, now we can add some more nuclear power plants because they help us with climate change. You know, a lot of the climate change people are pro-nuclear, and they get money from the nuclear industry to promote it.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to be careful of that. And so a lot of the environmentalists are saying, well, look, you know, we know it's not a good solution. We know it's terrible, but we'll take that because it's so bad that it might even stop these nuclear plants from going in.
Well, I understand that calculation. I personally don't run the calculation that way. And let me. I've got an on-screen comment here from Kate Ann in New York. She says she's getting the feed just fine. By the way, a couple of people had an interruption. She said, I am concerned about nuclear waste and global climate change causing rising waters, serious problem. So here's somebody, and obviously in 25 words, she can't explain herself completely. But I take it that she comes down on the side of dealing with nuclear waste first and then dealing with whatever issues that might lead to, like proliferation of new construction down the road. And
well,
I really think
yeah,
we
I do think,
we have
I do
to...
think it's the worst. It's a worse problem. Like there's people that are working on climate change. It's a bad problem. But how will it affect us? Well, in 100 years, we might have the ocean go up a little bit, and it would be disturbing. But people are not going to necessarily die from that. They will, but not directly. Meanwhile, predictions are we'll have another 7 big Fukushima-sized nuclear accidents in the next 100 years. That's mm-hmm. going to be bad. And so we've got to really take a look at it. I think that the nuclear issue is the most important issue on the table. In terms of safety.
I agree,
that's
Ray. And, you know, I've met Stuart Brand. He's a great big picture thinker. But he is one of the people who shifted on this issue and says, well, you know, the trade-off of nuclear power to reduce carbon emissions is one that he can embrace. And I don't agree with that. I think we do have to take the nuclear issue as a clear and present danger, and the climate change issue is a longer-term problem. But I simply don't think that more nuclear power plants is the solution to climate change.
Hey, thanks a lot, Peter.
All right, Ray, good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. And I want to thank everybody for watching and calling in today. I have one more item that I want to relate to you and encourage you to check out the article that I'm going to refer to. It's from The Intercept. And it's an interesting piece about Peter Thiel and his company, which is called Palantir. Now, Peter Thiel is an out gay man from Silicon Valley, claims to be a billionaire, investor in PayPal, and maybe it was also in eBay. I'm not positive about that. At any rate, Palantir is a startup of his that does business with the federal government. And The Intercept reported in March, early March, that Palantir is building a data platform called Investigative Case Management that allows immigration agents to query information across several large government databases. And in this article, The Intercept is raising concerns that ICE agents may have access to very sensitive classified surveillance-type information drawn from the FBI or the CIA. And this is another bit of mission creep where we're told, you know, that all of this is to secure our borders and to get all of these so-called illegals out of the country. But the long-term impact of using these databases in the manner described here in this article is just another area of concern about the creeping police state here in the United States. So I will link to it. And this podcast, if you're watching on Facebook, either live or on the replay, come on over to my website at peterbcollins.com, and that's where you will find the show file and the audio recording of today's podcast. And the show file often includes links to the articles that I have been referring to and commenting on. So thanks for joining me today for my news and comment podcast and the live Facebook feed. You can catch me every day at peterbcollins.com, and my daily podcast is also available on YouTube.
Happy trails to you until we meet again.